In recent years, opioid addiction has exploded across America. Communities all over the country are trying to come to grips with it. And for most people, this is something new. But in northern New Mexico, a heroin epidemic has been tearing away at the community for longer than many people there have been alive.
I know every type of drug. I've seen every type of drug.
Grandma does it, mom does it, dad did do it until he died.
I didn't really know who my mom was until I was like 2 or 3.
He does the needle kind of drugs. He gets like this foil.
My daughter, all I could do is sit there and watch her kill herself.
Drug epidemic hits a small community like this and doesn't go away, what happens to families, children, and the community at large? And what would it take to finally beat this problem? I'm Ed Williams, and this is Enduring Addiction, a special report from KUNM News. I'm Ed Williams. Thanks for joining us for this KUNM special, Enduring Addiction, the long fight against heroin in northern New Mexico.
Let me tell you where I come from. I'm the fifth generation.
This is Fidel Gutierrez. We're sitting in his family home in Velarde, New Mexico, a small town next to the Rio Grande, about an hour north of the state capital, Santa Fe. As you can probably hear, his roots here go way back. A lot of people's do. This is one of the oldest cultures in America. Native American Pueblo tribes and descendants of 16th century Spanish colonists still make up a big part of the population.
In Velarde, when I was growing up, you go up to the mountains, look down, all you would see is apple trees and acres and acres of chili.
Fidel was an apple farmer growing up. His family owned hundreds of acres of trees. He says back when he was a kid, life here was simple. This is one of the poorest parts of New Mexico today, but Fidel says back then it didn't take much money to live. People had plots of farmland they'd gotten from Spanish land grants where they could grow fruit and chili or cut timber from the mountains. Then came the Vietnam War.
When these people went to war, all these young people went to war. A lot of them came back that were hooked on drugs. And that's when drugs started after the war. A lot of drugs. Well, now it's a lot of drugs.
Heroin took hold here like nowhere else in the country. Just a few decades after Vietnam, the death rate from heroin in Rio Arriba County was higher than anywhere else in America. Since then, the problem's only gotten worse. It's an epidemic that's hit Fidel's family hard. All of his 6 kids have been addicted to heroin, and so have some of his grandkids.
Hi there. How are you?
Hey, what's up?
Hi.
Hello. Yona Gutierrez is Fidel's daughter and one of only 2 of his kids to make it through treatment. She lives with her 14-year-old son Eddie in Española, Rio Arriba County's biggest town. Yona went through some hard times recently. She's recovering from heroin addiction, and she lost custody of Eddie before she got into recovery. Now things are better, though. She's working at her family's restaurant and working on being a mom, too. Here's Eddie.
Yeah, it was hard, kind of growing up around here. And then with spending the first 5 years of my life with my grandma, because my mom was struggling with her own stuff. But, like, I mean, I didn't really know who my mom was until I was, like, 2 or 3.
What do you mean it was hard growing up here?
Like, you can't walk your dog around here and not see someone strung out or someone, like, on something or stuff like that.
That's very true. Even just, like, you know, I don't let him go for walks around here because even just where we live is, like, a lot of deals are going on right here. I mean, and there's syringes, and you know what I mean? Like, he can't go. I don't allow him to go over there, you know, which kind of sucks because, you know, he should be able to go for a walk.
Eddie's experimented with some drugs. He doesn't hide it from his mom. They're pretty upfront with each other. Yoni even takes Eddie to Narcotics Anonymous meetings with her.
I mean, I've experienced with pot before, and I mean, once I did, I liked the feeling, and so I kept doing it, and I just did a lot.
Eddie says most of his friends are in the same position, and the exposure to drugs doesn't just come from the streets. It comes from the people you hang out with.
Like, if you have a... if you, So if you never smoked pot before, just saying, because... And you're with a friend, and he pulls out, like, some pot, and he says, do you want to hit? You can't, like... They'll be like, oh, you'll be cool if you do it. A lot of peer pressure.
Maybe you remember that age when you felt insecure, when you were trying to find your identity, when you just wanted to fit in. Yona and a lot of the people I talked to say what was so tempting about using heroin at that age was that it made all those feelings of teenage angst go away. To see her son deal with those pressures all while trying to manage her own addiction, it keeps her up at night.
I'm just kind of trying to balance two very important lives, you know, and I've learned that I really had to, you know, take care of myself ultimately and in my recovery so that I could be a better mom to him, you know, because without me being able to do that, then I'm no good to my son. I'm terrified that he's gonna use harder drugs. Our whole family, from our nieces and nephews, and from my dad's children to grandchildren to great-grandchildren, are addicts. There's maybe two or three that are clean in our family. You know, we see it every day. And I try to have this house be like, you know, our safe place. You know, we don't allow alcohol in our house, drugs, you know, that kind of thing. So you can feel safe here, you know. It's hard.
Yona's doing everything she can to make sure Eddie doesn't get hooked on drugs. He likes to play guitar, he wants to be a musician or maybe an actor. One of the few after-school programs here where he can work on those things is a place called Moving Arts, a nonprofit run by a former gymnast named Roger Montoya.
One more. That was pretty nice.
Eddie comes here during the week, after school gets out, for guitar lessons and gymnastics classes. Right now, he's getting ready to dive over Coach Roger's arm.
Over my hand.
Eddie does an impressive front flip, nails his landing. There's a round of high fives and thumbs up from the class.
Eddie is doing so much better over the last 3 months. Earlier this year, I was very worried about him. He was having some very big challenges. And lately, as I'd say the last 6 weeks, he has a renewed sense of himself.
Roger's helping Eddie apply to the New Mexico School for the Arts, a charter school in Santa Fe. Eddie's pretty stoked on the idea, but he's got to get through eighth grade first. Once a week or so, Eddie meets up with a friend of his mom's after school named Donovan Hoffman. They have kind of a mentor thing going on. Donovan is a recovering heroin addict himself. He spent most of his teenage years in jail. He started using when he was Eddie's age. A lot of people do. 12, 13, 14. Most people I talked to here told me if a kid's going to pick up a drug habit, that's when it tends to happen.
So what's going on at school?
Huh?
What's going on at school?
Not much.
Like, really, really?
Like, you're getting in trouble? Not as much as I did.
Not as much as you were? For a kid in this town to stay away from drugs, it takes a lot. It takes, a whole team of people around that kid, you know? Because you can't expect that kid to just do that on their own. We know what's going on in this community. A lot of us have experienced it ourselves.
Yeah, and my mom said that she's, like, really glad that we're chilling and that I can go with you anytime.
Yeah. I just want you to do good. Like, I want you to know that, like, I mean, I've told you before, we've had those conversations of stuff you do now can affect you for the rest of your life.
Yeah.
Seriously. And it could be something that seems very little in that moment, but it can literally follow you for the rest of your life, and I just care about you.
For kids like Eddie, who are at risk for addiction, the stakes are really high. Because even though the heroin epidemic has been at crisis levels in Rio Arriba County for maybe longer than anywhere in America, most people here who need help getting clean can't find it. There's almost nowhere for people to go for detox, and the few treatment programs there are underfunded and pretty much always have a waiting list. Which means if Eddie's mom, Yona, relapses again, if she needs to find a detox center, chances are she won't be able to get into one. So she goes to her NA meetings, thinks about what her sobriety means for Eddie, and hopes for the best.
It's something that I have to work on every day of my life. You know, my disease will never go away. I have to go to meetings. I have to take care of myself. If not, then, you know, my disease is doing push-ups waiting for me to f*** up.
All right, I'm just going to go back.
This is Yona's nephew, Chuck. He's an active heroin user. He has been for years. He works at the family's restaurant with Yona in the kitchen.
Wakshi started at a young age.
It's the same story, the one everyone seems to have. You start experimenting around 12 or 13 with cigarettes and weed. At some point, someone you know introduces you to heroin. In this case, it was a girlfriend.
So I met this one gal, and then from there, it just really went downhill. She came from the same kind of family, too. At the time, she had started using behind my back. I didn't know about it, okay? So she was using behind my back, and curious cat here, I was like, what the hell is that? You know, I've heard about it. I've seen friends and actually even family members, you know, die from it. And, you know, and stupid ass me, I said, let me try it, you know. And we got high, you know, and it was the greatest feeling. You feel no pain. It's, you know, you totally mellow, you know. I kick myself in the ass every time I look back on that day.
You said the first time that you tried heroin, I mean, you were thinking about your family members that had overdosed and died.
Yeah.
You know, what? Why do you think you still tried it?
It's still a question that I ask myself all the time. I just wanted to see how it felt. And I thought at the same time, I thought that was the norm. You know, I thought everybody was normal. You know, people, that was normal. I thought it was normal to do that, you know, being coming from a family, seeing it growing up all my life, you know what I mean?
Now, Chuck says that great feeling is long gone. Heroin is elusive that way. After using it for a little while, the high goes away. Pretty soon, it becomes something you do just to stave off withdrawals. People who are addicted to heroin call it getting well.
I'm a functional addict. I still put food on the table, me and my girlfriend. We still go buy nice clothes. We, you know, have our vehicles. What stage we're in right now is we're using just because we have to get well. We have to stay well. We're not using to get high, but it's a physical drug. And right now, we're looking into getting into a treatment just to get off that because we're already sick and tired of being sick and tired.
We wrap up our interview. Chuck goes back to his house. Just 2 hours after we talked, Chuck found his roommate unconscious. She had died from an overdose. Behind the statistics, the reports of overdose death rates that come in like a slow drumbeat in Rio Riba County are stories like this one. Real people and real families losing loved ones for the same reason over and over again. A lot of those people end up here at Rivera Funeral Home in Española. Jim Martinez is the funeral director.
And, you know, so before we place somebody in the crematory, we always will pause even with a moment of silence just to commit them into the crematory. There's a wonderful thing here by Ruth Burgess, and it says, into the freedom of wind and sunshine we let you go. Into the dance of the stars and the planets we let you go. Into the wind's breath and the hands of the star maker we let you go. We love you, we miss you, we want you to be happy. Go safely, go dancing, go running home. You know, death is not a cookie cutter experience for anybody. It's as unique as a thumbprint. And drugs are the when a young person or an old person, whether they're, you know, homeless or a person of notoriety out here who has died from a drug overdose, the impact is pretty rough. I mean, if you're just sitting in this room here when clients come here, and I've had a room full of relatives who are just devastated, but they somehow grapple with it, deal with it. We set up services so that they can remember and memorialize and honor and respect that person no matter what they died from. But it's, you know, the drug thing is it's pretty terrible.
How often do you see people coming through here who died from an overdose or, you know, something drug-related?
Well, we're one of two firms here in town, but we see something like this every week.
Every week?
Every week.
Remember, this is a pretty small town. It's tight-knit. Each one of these deaths reverberates here throughout the whole community. It's a constant cloud hanging over. Your brother, your friend from work, that girl you sat next to in English class. Drugs have made life a fragile thing. You never really know whose obituary you'll be reading next, and you're never really surprised when you do. After I met with Yona and Eddie at their house, Yona stopped answering my calls. I talked to someone who knew her, and they said it seemed like she was going through a hard time, that maybe she'd relapsed. Eventually, I decided to check in on her in person. Okay, I haven't heard from Eddie or Yona in, like, I don't know, 3 weeks or so, and I'm getting kind of worried about them. Yona hasn't returned any of my phone calls. Donovan's been trying to get a hold of Eddie. I feel kind of weird about this, but I'm just going to go up to their door right now and knock, see if everything's cool. I walk up to the house, knock on the door.
Hi.
A guy I don't know comes to the door looking really tired and like he does not want to be on the microphone. He says Yona's not there, and he'll tell her to call me when he sees her. I never hear back. And maybe she just didn't want to talk again. Maybe she lost my number, or she was just too busy. Maybe it was something worse. It made me realize this must be just a small taste of the feeling that people keep telling me about, the feeling of always being worried about your friends and family, not knowing if an unanswered phone call meant something was really wrong. Coming up, when people dealing with addiction can't find help from detox and treatment programs, it's the police who have to pick up the slack.
You meet the families, you know, and they're crying out for help.
That's just ahead. Stay with us. I'm Ed Williams, and this is KUNM. Welcome back. I'm Ed Williams, and this is Enduring Addiction, a KUNM special.
You can already smell the narcotics in here. We have weapons usually set up over here. See all along this wall here, there's numerous weapons in these bags.
This is Detective Eric Gallant of the Espanola Police Department. With a population of around 10,000 people, this is where most of the drug trafficking and drug-related crime happens. Detective Gallant is showing me the department's evidence locker. And for a town this size, the amount of contraband in here is pretty crazy.
You can see a sawed-off shotgun right there with the pistol grip. And the thing is, too, a lot of this stuff, they're stolen items and stuff, a lot of this stuff has to do with, you know, narcotics.
As Gallant is telling me this story, he and the evidence room supervisor are sifting through a big crate full of drugs they've seized. Like other parts of the country, prescription painkillers like hydrocodone are often the gateway to opioid addiction. But Gallant and others I spoke to say heroin, which is cheaper and easier to get, makes up the bulk of drugs in town. He rummages through confiscated bags full of little blobs of black tar heroin, other bags of powdered heroin called Mexican brown. There's stacks of pipes and paraphernalia. There's a good bit of meth, too, which Gallant says is on the rise lately.
We also had a pretty large case about a month ago. The subject came out with an AK-47 and started shooting at the people in the truck. Eventually, two other male subjects came and stabbed the two victims in the truck.
You know, this isn't a big town, but these are like big city problems that you guys are
getting. Yeah. You know, and like I was speaking with you earlier, they used to have the approximately 48 officers in the 1980s. And now, Fran, what are you at, about 23, 22?
Yeah, 23 with the DC and the chief.
Mm-hmm. That's including our higher command staff, which is the chief and the deputy chief. So as you can see, it's been cut in half.
I tried for weeks to get an interview with the mayor to talk about cuts to the police department. There was a lot I wanted to talk to her about, actually, but she wouldn't talk to me. Anyway, Detective Gallant says the department gets by the best it can on the resources it has. He's got it especially hard, since he's the only narcotics detective on the force. And that's frustrating for officers and for families.
You meet the families, you know, and they're crying out for help.
That's the chief of police, Richard Gallegos. He's no stranger to addiction. He's had problems with heroin in his family, too. So have officers on patrol. Some have even had to arrest their own family members for drug crimes.
And, you know, a lot of the families, you know, they request, they ask us, you know, he wants to get help. She wants to get help. But sometimes you don't have anything to send him to, you know. It is a cycle, and it's just a revolving door. You know, and it's very, very frustrating.
Police here do not think that just getting tough on drugs is going to solve the problem. Every officer I talked to described addiction as a disease, not a crime. It's not something law enforcement can deal with alone. And the Española Police Department has tried to take a harm reduction approach. New Mexico is the first state to implement a Good Samaritan law, protecting people calling 911 to report an overdose. And the Española PD was the first police department in the Southwest to start carrying the overdose-reversing drug naloxone on patrol. Officers say they don't proactively target drug users. But if they see a crime being committed, they have to make an arrest. And usually, going to jail just means the person's addiction will get worse.
Right now, this is proactive patrolling, proactive policing. So it's basically we're going out, you know, even...
A little while later, Detective Gallant goes out on a routine patrol through town and lets me tag along.
You know, just have an officer presence there so people know that law enforcement's out. Of course,
just a few minutes into the patrol, an SUV blows through a red light while speeding. Gallant notices a guy ducking down in the back seat.
Yeah. See that moving around a lot? See, I 2 SPL. Somebody just ducked in the back. See, he knows. I don't like this setup like this.
Gallant pulls over the car, tells the driver and passenger to get out. 2 young guys, 20-somethings in jeans and t-shirts. Both look pretty unfazed, like they've been through this 100 times. Detective Gallant motions me over.
So these are called cookers. They put the heroin in there, dilute it with water or saline, whatever, and cook it down to put it in a syringe. Just thought I'd show that to you. And look what we got here. It's just everywhere, you know what I mean?
Inside the car are about 7 or 8 heroin cookers. There's the unmistakable, pungent smell of heroin.
I smell that vinegar, too.
And the center console is full of empty syringes.
It's like 10 in each bag. Look, what we got here?
Gallant also finds a loaded syringe with about 3 hefty doses of heroin in it, hidden in the back seat.
This guy's going to end up going to jail for possession of heroin. He admitted and said this was his. That's why he's in the back room where he said he's ducking around and stuff. Is hiding it under, so. Come over here real quick, partner.
The guy who took the rap for the drugs gets into a police car with a blank and almost bored look on his face. While all this is going down, a woman walks past, smiling and waving.
Thank you for what you do. I want you to know there are citizens that appreciate this.
Her name's Luella Bustos. She seems really happy to see all this happening.
I'm actually, it's very grievous when I think of what is going on within our county and our city. These young men do a fine job and they try really hard, but let's face it, a lot falls through the cracks. It's just a wish I have to see something greater happen because they have what is necessary. They're trained. It's stretched like a rubber band as far as they can go.
I later learned that Luella's nephew was the guy who was driving the car that got pulled over. What feels really weird about all this is just how casual it all is. Nobody seems fazed by it at all. Gallant says it's pretty much just a daily occurrence here. He finds drugs on about 1 out of every 3 cars he pulls over during patrol. He knows the 2 boys he just pulled over from before, and he says he'll probably see them again. The guy heading to jail won't get the counseling and rehab he needs while he's behind bars. That revolving door police talk about? This is it in action. This whole thing, with people getting locked up over and over again because of their addiction, one of the reasons it's such a problem for this community is that it breaks up families. A lot of people that get arrested for drug-related crimes are moms and dads. What happens to their kids when they go to jail? What happens to their ability to be parents when they get out?
You know, she knows her dad's in prison because of addiction. I know there was a time when she asked me if she could talk to the judge.
Did you wanted to talk to the judge?
Yeah.
What did you want to tell the judge?
That if they can give my dad another chance to get out and for him to get a second chance on his life.
That's just ahead. Just a short drive from Española is the town of Chimayo, New Mexico. This is where Lupe Salazar grew up. She's lived in the same house here since she was three. Now she's in her 50s. She's a local community activist, and she works on family and addiction issues. We meet up on a school day at about 7 a.m. She's brushing her granddaughter Nivea's hair, getting her ready for her third grade class.
Sorry. I got it off the hair guy.
And today she's allowing me to
braid my hair.
Yeah, because you're coming over. It's usually just the ponytail, and I tell her.
Nivea's little sister, Star, takes a break from rattling her pencil case to pick up a picture of a family of smiling stick figures.
Mama! That's you and me! That's you and me, Mama! That's you, me, and sister, and my daddy.
Mama isn't really Mama. That's what she calls her Grandma Lupe. Because for most of Star's life, that's what she's been. Her real mom is addicted to heroin, and her dad, Lupe's son, is in prison. Lupe's been caring for Nivea and Star on and off for several years now.
So, what's it like living with Grandma?
It's better than living with my mom.
Why?
Because, like, sure, like, I get in trouble, but I don't get, like, smacked and stuff.
Nivea and Star have been through some really tough times. Back when Lupe was trying to get custody of the girls, she says Nivea told the state caseworker that there were drugs in the house, that men would come through the window at night and sleep with her mom while the girls were in the room. Now Lupe's in a position she didn't expect to be in, a single grandmother, all of a sudden caring for two little girls on her own, raising them as best she can.
She,
you know, Nivea wants to, in the night, she'll tell me, come in, love me, you know. She's like, no, you love me. And I'm like, no, you know. I read her a story. And so we have to teach to share. And that's probably one of my hardest obstacles. It's just crazy, the competition. But you know that I have noticed, and that's why I will do what I can to make sure that the girls stay together.
I get the feeling Lupe underplays what a tough job she has. I ask her if it's hard for her to raise two little girls, to be a mom all over again, and she smiles, says it is what it is, and we make the best of it. For her, it's all about making sure the girls have what they need, that they have a safe place to call home. When I ask Nivea about her experience with addiction, I can see why Lupe feels so protective.
What do you think about drugs?
I think they're horrible, because they got my dad into a very bad place.
Do you know a lot about drugs?
Yes, I do. From my mom's other boyfriend, he does the needle kind of drugs. He gets like this foil and gets a straw and smokes it. He smokes weed. He smokes cigarettes, and he does it in front of me and stuff. So.
Do you have friends that have seen the same things?
Yeah, from their dads and their moms, they've seen the same thing I have.
What do they think?
They think that it's really bad, and they're sad that they can't see their parents because of it.
Nivea's understanding of addiction is pretty nuanced, especially for an 8-year-old. Her dad, Fernando, who's been struggling with heroin Nivea's whole life, she doesn't blame him for his addiction. In fact, she really misses him. So does Star. A few months ago, though, Fernando got transferred to the state prison in Hobbs in southeastern New Mexico. That's a 5.5-hour drive from Lupe's home in Chimayo. It's too far for the family to travel with young Star. Now, phone calls are all the communication the little girls have with their dad until he gets paroled. As Nivea and I are talking, she looks down at the table like she's imagining something.
I have a picture of him, which is at my school, but it's in my desk, in my classroom.
Why do you keep a picture?
So I can remember him.
Hello, this is a free call from an inmate at DEO Group, Lean County Facility. This call is subject to recording and monitoring.
Fernando.
Hello.
yeah, is this it?
It is. How are you doing? Thanks for
calling. This is Star Nivea's dad, Fernando. His drug habit actually started in jail after he got picked up for a DWI when he was a teenager. He met a guy inside who introduced him to heroin.
I've wasted all my life, a big part of my life for nothing. I've lost people that I'm never going to get back. I've destroyed just relationships with other people.
Fernando's been in and out of jail his whole adult life for nonviolent crimes he says are related to his addiction.
Nobody else should have to suffer because of all the I went through. My kids especially, I tell my daughter, my oldest one, I'm trying to show her with examples that it's not a good lifestyle. I mean, I talk to her every day on the phone. And she's already dealing with these problems, and she shouldn't even have to. She's a third grader.
So what do you want for your girls?
I want what every other parent wants for their kid. I want my kids to succeed, and I don't want my kids to make the same mistakes I did. But I don't want my kids to think that the friends they have or the family that they have that turn out like me are 100% bad and rotten to the core. They're not.
Having a parent in jail is traumatic for young kids, and childhood trauma can make kids more vulnerable to addiction themselves. But having a parent get out and relapse because there are no effective treatment programs, that's traumatic too. Each time Fernando gets out of jail, he looks for help, or help with his addiction, help with job training, parenting skills, but he can never find it before he ends up back in jail again. Fernando tells me about the time last summer when the U.S. congressman for this district held a big community forum on substance abuse and barriers to treatment in Rio Riba County. Representative Ben Ray Lujan, he does a lot of work on addiction issues. Fernando was on parole then, and at that meeting he stood up in front of a room full of people and said he needed help finding a program.
I'm the druggie, I'm the bad person, whatever, I'm the poster child for our community. I'm that person that all these programs and this whole problem originates around. So that's why I told, even the congressman and everybody else that has been involved in this, I told him, look, I just paroled. Let's see how long it takes for me to get this help. And I came back and I never got the help.
Now he's back in jail. He's away from his kids, and he's not getting the addiction counseling or other services that could help him break the cycle. So I followed up with Congressman Ben Ray Lujan about why Fernando and so many others like him fall into this pattern. I wanted to know, how can it be that in a place like this, decades into a devastating heroin epidemic, people like Fernando can't find help with their addiction?
There's not enough support, whether it's at the local level or at the federal level, or even with the amount of support that exists philanthropically, even in that space. There's not even a real inventory and clearinghouse across New Mexico nor across America with the available beds that may exist today.
He's talking about beds and recovery and detox centers. Lujan says getting people treatment could help them from getting locked up again.
Incarcerating individuals who are fighting addiction is not going to help them, and it's not going to cure the issue. That the system's backwards.
Back at Lupe's house, school is about to start, and Lupe's got Nivea's backpack in one hand, Star's stuffed animal in the other. She's doing that classic last minute before school scramble.
We have toys and wrappers.
This part of the day is always tough. The girls don't like being apart. Star always gets upset after Nivea goes off to school. There's a long road ahead for Lupe's family. When Fernando does get out of prison, even if he gets into an addiction treatment program that works, he'll have to find a way to earn money for himself and the girls, how to function outside prison, and he'll have to learn how to be a dad. Lupe will have to keep being a mom to her son and her granddaughters.
Have a good day, stay warm.
Bye.
Bye, honey, I love you.
Sometimes I feel so bad is the word, like leaving her where I know that she's not protected.
Lupe spent a lot of time thinking about how her community ended up where it is today. She says the roots of this problem go back a long way, like way back, before Vietnam, all the way back to the Native American revolts against their Spanish colonizers and America's expansion into this part of the Southwest. So many people lost their land and their identity. So many people live in poverty here today. She says it's really not surprising that once drugs took hold, they didn't let go. That got her wondering, how do we fix a problem that has such deep roots? So she got together with other people from the community who were asking the same questions and formed a nonprofit called Barrios Unidos. Azul Laluz was a board member.
You know, there's a saying in New Mexico, and in particularly in the valley, and the saying is, we never cross the border. The border crossed us. And it's that sense of being betrayed, that sense of losing heritage, of losing voice, of losing their tongue, you know. So there's so many variables that created this cultural post-traumatic stress disorder that the majority of drug addicts are suffering. And then many people are suffering here.
Azul is recovering from heroin addiction himself. He spent his teenage years in prison. Now he has a PhD in medical sociology. For his dissertation, he researched overdoses in northern New Mexico and found that a lot of them weren't accidental. They were suicides. People had given up hope. He says it doesn't have to be that way. Step one in fixing the addiction crisis, he says, is rebuilding that lost sense of community.
Given the right tools, given the right assistance, We dopamines, we drug addicts can make it, you know. It's not a death sentence, although unfortunately around here it tends to be that sometimes.
What we know about addiction has grown a lot lately. The science is strong, and there's a bigger consensus now on how to solve the problem than there's ever been. Up next, we'll hear from some of the people who've been studying the impacts of addiction and ways we could stop the epidemic. This is Enduring Addiction, a KUNM special report. I'm Ed Williams. Welcome back. I'm Ed Williams, and this is Enduring Addiction, a KUNM special.
I've been here for 20 years, and 20 years ago when I came upon this and said, wow, this is a huge issue.
This is Dr. Fernando Bayardo. He runs the emergency room at Presbyterian Hospital in Española.
If this in fact were meningitis, if it were a hantavirus, with these ratios and these percentages per capita, the CDC would be all over it and say, my gosh, we got to run in here and do something. But it's overdose deaths, and it's heroin, and there's a stigma associated with it.
For years, the drug epidemic in Rio Arriba County got hardly any attention at all outside the medical workers like Dr. Bayardo who were treating patients, and that made the problem a lot worse. But in some ways, things have started to turn around now. Prescription opioid monitoring programs and funding for a nasal spray called naloxone that can reverse overdoses have been implemented, and overdose rates are actually starting to fall, even though they're still 50% higher than they were in the late 90s when Rio Arriba had the highest death rate from heroin in America. But Dr. Bayardo says just focusing on overdoses actually hides how big of a public health problem addiction is.
Overdose deaths and overdoses are the tip of the iceberg. There's a whole slew of other medical conditions that overshadow overdose deaths, but for some reason we're not as aware of those.
Like what?
Well, let's start with hepatitis C. We suspect that from the statistics that I've read that every individual that's infected with hepatitis C virus probably infects 20 other people. The majority of all the patients that I encounter who are using injected heroin are hepatitis C positive.
There's also kidney disease, skin infections, cardiovascular problems. Dr. Bayardo says that when you take all the health problems associated with heroin into account, drug-related medical emergencies make up anywhere between 50 and 75% of the people coming into the ER in Española on a given day. The costs to the community are huge. and not just in dollars, in life expectancy too. The average male life expectancy in Rio Arriba County is 10 years shorter than that of men living just up the road in New Mexico's wealthiest county, Los Alamos, where the median income is over $100,000.
Think of drug use as a symptom. Don't think of it as the problem.
That's Dr. Anthony Iton. He specializes in community health and inequality at the California Endowment.
And I think that that's typically where we get into trouble, because we decide the problem is drug use, and at the root of that problem is some sort of immorality or, you know, lack of personal responsibility on behalf of the people who are using drugs. But when a whole community is subject to that, this is not about individuals. There's a structural problem, and you described it with Los Alamos being right next door, which does not have that problem. And people came home from Vietnam in Los Alamos, too. But it didn't take root. Why?
Poverty, food insecurity, instability for children and families, the lack of policies and programs to address those things, Iton says that's what really has to change if the drug crisis in Rio Arriba County is ever going to really end. Treatment alone won't get at the root causes of the epidemic. But funding detox, treatment and counseling, and making it available for people who need help would make a huge difference for the hundreds of people who are trying to turn their lives around right now. And now that the opioid epidemic has gone national, there's a big push for making treatment more available in places like Rio Arriba County, from some pretty influential places. Hello?
Hi, this is Vivek Murthy here. How are you?
Vivek Murthy is Surgeon General of the United States. He just published the first ever Surgeon General's report on addiction and recovery.
For far too long, we've had millions of people in America who have been living in the shadows, suffering with addiction, and it's time for us to change that. We have 20.8 million people in America who have a substance use disorder. That's about the same number of people who have diabetes, and it's 1.5 times the number of people who have all cancers combined. But what is tragic about this is that only 1 in 10 people with a substance use disorder are getting treatment.
You also talk about the need for a major cultural shift, right, in the way that we're thinking about addiction. What do you mean by that?
Well, we have to shift how we think about addiction, because right now far too many people have negative associations with addiction. Too many people see addiction as a disease of choice. Addiction is, in fact, a disease of the brain, that, and in particular, there are three parts of the brain that are affected, parts that control our decision-making, impulses, as well as our stress and reward systems. And when we understand this, when we understand that substance use disorders fundamentally change the circuitry of our brain in these areas, we start to recognize why relapse is so easy with substance use disorders, that it's actually not a question of, of insufficient will. But it's, in fact, due to changes in the brain, which impact our ability to control decisions and impulses.
Murthy says there will always be a risk of relapse, but with treatment programs that are proven to work, we can bring relapse rates down to the same levels we have for things like hypertension or diabetes. But it's not a one-and-done process. Murthy says treating addiction takes years, and we all have a role to play.
All of us can provide the kind of environment that provides support and compassion to folks who are living with substance use disorders. Everyone I have met as I've traveled around the country who has gone through that dark tunnel of addiction and who's come out, in a place of recovery, has said that what helped them get through was usually an individual or group of people who provided them with support, who believed in them when others gave up. People who are a source of compassion in their lives. Everyone needs that who is living with a substance use disorder. You know, this would be a very different crisis if we didn't know how to address it or if there were no evidence-based treatment strategies available. But that's not the case. We know what to do. Science has told us what strategies work. That doesn't mean that we are through this crisis. It means that we have reason to believe that we can succeed.
All the ingredients to stop this epidemic are there. The top doctor in the country is throwing his weight behind treatment programs, some of which are already in place in Rio Arriba County, even if they're out of reach for so many people. There's broad bipartisan support for fixing the problem, too. Congress overwhelmingly passed several bills in late 2016 aimed at tackling this epidemic, including one that allots $1 billion for more treatment and prevention. But we're not there yet. Not even close. Right now, in places like Española, people who are desperate for help still can't get it. How often, when someone comes in asking for help, is there nowhere to send them?
I'd say 9 times out of 10.
We'll take a look at the barriers to recovery and a program that does work up next. In downtown Española, in a strip mall across from the Super Save grocery store, is a little office with a handmade sign that reads Inside Out Recovery. This is the front line in the battle for addiction treatment in Rio Riba County. When someone hits rock bottom, when they decide it's time to get help, this is where they come first. A team of counselors, most of them recovering from their own heroin addictions, sits down with people walking in from off the streets, talks to them about the detox and treatment process, and then starts making phone calls to try and find a bed in a detox program for them. Sometimes it goes smoothly. Usually, it doesn't.
So that's the problem that we're facing is that...
On a recent Thursday afternoon, a guy walks into Inside Out named Dominic Ortiz. He's a familiar face around here. He's been trying to get help with his heroin addiction for months. The crew here has made phone call after phone call, looking for a bed for him with no luck. Now, there's a new wrinkle. He's been taking an anti-anxiety drug to try to help him quit on his own. It hasn't been working.
I took him to try not to use, you know, and to kind of knock myself out, but it didn't work that way.
And Josh Trujillo and Abe Gordon, the counselors working with Dominic, say if he tests positive for anxiety drugs, it will disqualify him from a lot of detox centers.
I mean, we could go ahead and call and try and see what they say, but more than likely they're going to recommend that he go into a medical detox.
Which is what? Where?
Turquoise Lodge.
We've tried that already. This guy's been on a waiting list with Turquoise Lodge for 3 months now.
That's Turquoise Lodge. They do detox and treatment in Albuquerque. Finally, they decide to try a place in Santa Fe, an hour's drive away.
Santa Fe Recovery.
Hi, my name is Joshua Trujillo. I work with Inside Out Recovery in Española. I'm calling in regards to a client of mine who is interested in getting into your program.
It ends up being kind of a complicated process. Dominic will have to wait a few days, find a way to get to Santa Fe where he'll have to pay $10 for a drug screening. Then if a nurse approves him for their residential treatment program, he'll get his name on the waiting list. They can't tell him how long the waiting list is.
Okay, because it's a hard thing because, you know, the client, he doesn't have transportation, he doesn't have money. So to come up with a ride to Santa Fe and $10... It'd be nice to know what kind of waiting list we're looking at.
To someone listening from the outside, this might not sound like the end of the world. So you have to drive for an hour, pay $10, and wait for a while before you start treatment. What's the big deal? But for someone addicted to heroin, each of those obstacles is just another reason to say, I can't do it. Abe and Josh say a lot of times when this happens, clients will walk out and never come back. Sometimes they die from an overdose after asking for help and not finding it.
Well, I guess our hands are kind of tied with this one, and so, you know, hopefully you will see him early next week.
Okay. Thank
awesome.
You.
Well, thank you. Wow.
Josh hangs up the phone. He and Abe are both clearly frustrated they couldn't find a place for Dominic to go today. They ask if Dominic has everything he needs to get by till his appointment, and they walk out of the room onto their next client. Dominic sticks around. He seems upset.
Well, you just made an appointment for hopefully a recovery program. I mean, how are you feeling now?
I'm feeling good. I'm feeling very positive, and I know that's a step in the right direction, you know?
Do you think you can, I mean, can you make it till Monday?
Right now, I'm not going to lie or bull anyone. I probably am going to have to find my own, I would have to say, like, self-medication. I would guess I would say it's not something that, oh, how come you just don't stop? It's not that easy, you know? People lie still and kill and deal for these types of drugs, and I just don't want to go through that process anymore, you know?
Monday comes, and Dominic misses his appointment in Santa Fe. He managed to get the $10 for the screening, but then he ran out of gas. It's hard to show just how much of a burden not being able to get someone into treatment right away is for the counselors at Inside Out. They've been in the shoes of the people who walk in the door, who want to get better and are asking for help. They know it's life or death. Turning someone away in those circumstances is agonizing for them, and they have to do it over and over and over again. Because help usually just isn't there. And when it is, the complicated process of getting it tends to be too much for someone who's just barely surviving.
It caused so much sadness in my heart. I was very upset. I drove around screaming and crying and praying one day. I was just so upset.
This is Kathy Sutherland Brawl. She's the director at Inside Out Recovery.
Because to see people personally, face to face, and see that they have children and they have lives and they're asking for help, but there's no help. And there's nothing we can do but give them a hug. To me, this is unconscionable. It's an unconscionable thing.
If there's any good news here, it's that we know what the solution is. Treatment works. There are all kinds of scientifically proven ways to help someone overcome their addiction and to stay clean and productive after. Recovery from opioid addiction is not an easy process, but it can be done. Even though people here have a really hard time getting into treatment, finding help is not impossible. If you can get into detox, and if you get the medical clearance you need to start a recovery program, and if you manage to find one that has a space open, things can work out. Last fall, I went to visit Oi Recovery Center, the one detox and recovery spot in the county. When I was there, I met a young mother in her early 20s.
I have a son. I'm actually pregnant right now.
She was 2 months into the inpatient recovery program, and she wanted to talk about her recovery for this story, about why she made the decision to try and get help. She would only talk on the condition that we not use her name, though, because she said the stigma around addiction is still so strong that she was afraid of the consequences of being on the radio after she got out.
When I get out, I'm going to be a better person, and I'm going to do it for myself and be a better mom and live the dreams that I want to live, because on drugs, you can't live that dream that you want to live. Everybody has dreams.
Her dream is to be a good mom, to raise her kids in a happy home, and to become a drug counselor to help people win their fight with addiction. Her own fight with addiction hasn't been easy, she said, but the program was helping.
This is my community, and I've seen a lot of young kids pass away, and it's always from a drug overdose. Always from a drug overdose. I lost my dad when he was 26 years old. I was 5, and he was a heroin addict. That kills me every day that I wake up, because I think about it. What if I were to pass away? My children would be like, what a selfish mom we had. That's what I don't want to do. Is I don't want to be a selfish person anymore, and I want my children to have a mother.
A few weeks after we met at the treatment center, she failed a drug test and got expelled from the program. I talked to her on the phone a few weeks later, and she insisted she hadn't taken any drugs. After that, she stopped answering my calls. This is one of the hardest lessons to learn about addiction. Relapse happens. Even when you think you're on the up and up, sometimes when things look the brightest, your disease can take you backwards. I met another patient that day at Oi named Erin Borrego.
It's called Sunday Morning in Advaya. And Advaya is the valley. La Pastoras began their morning praying for the hurting people.
While Erin was in recovery, she wrote this poem about the cycle of addiction here, about the same story that's been repeating itself since those soldiers came back from Vietnam 40 years ago.
The beautiful Takata, also known as Mom, stumbles out the door. Mama, aren't you going to church with us today? You promised.
Hearing Erin describe it, once you get into treatment, it's kind of a strange feeling. Finally, you have a chance to get better, but at the same time, you have so many friends that could not get help. It's part excitement about your future, part fear of whether you'll be able to keep it together after you finish the program, and maybe sometimes part guilt that you found help and your friends are still out there.
With God, all things are possible. With God, all things are possible. I need to finish it.
Erin says she always finishes her poems, but for some reason, she hasn't been able to finish this one. Because how do you finish a story about an epidemic that never ends? It's been around as long as most people can remember.
My best friend from kindergarten is using every single one of my best friends are out there. There are very good people, and their lives need to be saved, and they're not all scumbags and, you know, awful people that deserve to die. Like, we deserve to live.
A month after we talked, Erin made it through the treatment program at Oi. She found an opening at a transitional housing place, but she had to go all the way to Albuquerque.
So this is our cute little living room. My room's a little messy, and we got kids in here.
I feel really good. I've never been in, like, the state of mind before in my whole entire life.
There's nowhere like this in Rio Arriba County, no transitional housing that has oversight and support for addiction recovery, which means a lot of people who do finish treatment end up right back in the same environment that made their addiction possible in the first place.
Like, coming here probably literally, like, saved my life, you know? Because my parents, like, I come out and it's like, she's clean, she's recovered, everything's perfect. I'm like, no, I'm working on the behaviors that came along with my addiction. I'm working with setting boundaries with, you know, there's so many things that come along with it. I'm not perfect. I am still human. You know, I am still an addict. I am. I'm not using, but...
But now, Erin says the future looks so much brighter. Once she's able to live on her own, she wants to go back to school, become a social worker or an addiction counselor. She says what she really wants to do is help people. But for now, it's one day at a time.
Literally one day at a time. Because 2 days ago, I was jumping ahead of myself and thinking, like, months from now, and it was consuming me. I was filled with anxiety and fear and rage towards the fact that I was feeling those things. It was interesting, but luckily I was able to, you know, because of the stuff that I learned at OI, I was able to come back and be more present and remember that I'm only able to focus on today.
A few weeks ago, I got some good news from the folks at Inside Out. Dominic, that guy who wasn't able to get into treatment, he finally found a program after trying for 4 months. Now, he's enrolled in community college. Fernando, Star and Nivea's dad, got out of jail early this year. Now he's back at home with the girls, making up for lost time. He's still looking for support to kick his addiction. I especially want to thank all the people who shared their stories for this project. It took a lot of courage, and a lot of them you didn't even hear from today. I'm Ed Williams, and you've been listening to Enduring Addiction, The Long Fight Against Heroin in Northern New Mexico. This 6-part series was produced as a project for the Dennis A. Hunt Fund for Health Journalism and the National Health Journalism Fellowship, programs at the Center for Health Journalism at USC's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism. KUNM's Public Health New Mexico project is funded by the W.K. Kellogg Foundation and the McCune Charitable Foundation. Find out more and listen to all of the stories in the series online at publichealthnm.org.